Hiya, Tim here with messages before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. All songs written and composed by Peter Gill, Holly Johnson, Brian Nash and Mark O'Toole, except where noted. The World Is My Oyster is also written by Andy Richards. War was written by Barrett Strong and Norman Whitfield. Ferry was written by Jerry Marsden. Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. And San Jose by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Welcome to the Pleasure Dome was released on the 29th of October 1984 on ZTT. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess and I'm excited to be sitting down with another artist to play back an album together. I've had so many enjoyable conversations with guests from The Kinks, to Keane, to Sleeper and Catatonia. To catch up with any of these episodes, you just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts to discover a whole archive of past listening parties. Just like Tim's Twitter Listening Party, a huge part of this is your involvement. So please get involved on social media throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out at Tim underscore Burgess and at Absolute Radio on X for more Listening Party content. This episode, I'm joined by Holly Johnson. Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Welcome to the Pleasure Dome stands out as one of the most iconic album releases of the 1980s. Musically, it soundtracked the middle of the decade as Frankie's dominated the charts. This album containing three consecutive number one singles in the UK. They also dominated the conversations of the time. The record steeped in controversy with on-air bands, shocking videos, and less controversially, everyone wearing a Frankie Says Relax t-shirt. It's a long album, so let's get into it. We're going to talk about Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
Okay.
But I want to know...
Did we do that on Twitter?
We've done something... We did something on Twitter, yeah. And you missed the first one, if I remember rightly.
Oh, no, that wasn't... I think that was Liverpool.
Oh, was that one? That one was for Liverpool?
I think so. Yeah, I think that was for Liverpool.
We got the wrong week, didn't we?
I just, you know... Space cadetted...
But it all worked out in the end, which it always does. You know, yeah. We've met a few times, haven't we?
And we have.
We did something at the Union Chapel as well.
Oh yeah. Was that the Power?
I think it was like the
Love?
Christmas. Yeah,
the
you did
Christmas
Power of Love. Yeah,
show.
Yeah. Very, very good. Very good. And obviously, I'd like to know, if you don't mind, filling me in on everything that happened before Frankie. Really, I mean, I have evidence here that you existed on record with Big in Japan.
I did, yeah.
And I think it would be good to start this whole, you know, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome story pre-Frankie.
Okay, well, I was playing acoustic guitar and singing before Big in Japan.
Yeah.
And I did a few support dates with a band called the Spitfire Boys.
Right.
I was friends with Jane Casey, yeah, who was singing in Big Japan, and there was another singer called Kevin Ward, and he didn't want to play bass any longer and
right,
just wanted to sing, yeah, with alongside Jane. Yeah. And so they'd heard I played acoustic guitar. So Bill and Ian Brody auditioned me.
Bill Drummond.
Yeah, Bill, yeah, Drummond and, yeah, Ian Brody.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, can you play the bass? I said, well, I've never played the bass, so I can play acoustic guitar. And they said, play something. So I think I played the riff from Andy Warhol by David Bowie. And used my little finger. And that impressed them enough to give me the job, which I did, rehearsed every day at Eric's Club in the daytime. Occasionally I didn't turn up, which used to annoy them, because I was 16,
yeah,
Bill,
yeah,
was 26,
yeah,
and
yeah,
I think Ian was 18 months older than me, Jane was 4 years, and then when Budgie joined, first of all, it was Phil, the drummer.
Yeah.
And Budgie was a bit older than me. I was just a kid, basically, that went a bit wild at the weekend. Yeah. Sometimes hitchhiked to London, or 1 week I didn't come back on time. So that caused...
So you missed the practice.
Yeah, that caused great trouble in the camp. So I was in Big Japan from 16 to 18 years old. We did a couple of peel sessions end.
Yeah.
But I didn't play on Big in Japan by Big in Japan because that single was released before I joined the group.
Right, okay. So this is an EP from Y to Z and Never Again.
Yeah, that's a sort of posthumous record.
Yeah, because it's like two slightly different lineups, right? One on side A and one on side B. Is that right?
There are two slight... I think the only one I'm not on is Cindy and the Barbie Dolls.
Yeah, Cindy and the Barbie Dolls.
Which I'm glad because I don't like that song.
So we've got here... You don't like that? It's good to not be on a song that you don't like.
Yeah, exactly. On the others. They were all, like, properly recorded demos for Warner Chappell Music.
I mean, this is like a who's who of, like, Liverpool celebrities. Bill Drummond... Yourself, Ian Brody.
Yeah, it's
Budgie,
been...
Budgie, you know, Creatures and
it's
Susie.
It's been described as a super group
Ah, right, I like that. That's good. That's good. So I guess Eric's was like a big meeting point for future heroes.
Yeah, it was a scene, and Roger Eagle and Pete Fulwell and Ken Testey, who managed... Deaf School.
Yes.
Which were an inspirational band.
They still play now and again, right?
They do. They were great. They were the art school band and they won the Battle of the Bands Melody Makers annual competition.
I actually went to see them at the 100 Club recently.
Oh, great. Well, they're still great. And Rico Casalac Jr. and... Betty Bright.
Yes,
and
Betty Bright.
Various characters. They had these wacky names, which I think was quite influential to the later punk thing, where everyone had these wacky names. Ken Testey was their manager, and he formed Eric's with Roger Eagle, who used to run the stadium, which was a venue in Liverpool. Yeah. So, after being in Japan, I recorded two solo singles for... The Eric's label.
Eric's label, that's right, I remember reading
under
that.
The name Holly.
Yeah.
Pete DeFratis was supposed to play on Hobo Joe, the second one. He played on the demo.
Right.
He was the drummer from Echo and the Bunny Men. Yeah. He was a lovely man. But in the end, I had Gary Dwyer from Teardrop Explodes playing on it.
Right.
Who had no rehearsals or anything. And we only had about an hour in some studio in Manchester.
Yeah.
And I remember the guy from The Fall being in...
recorded.
We had about an hour to make the record. And the guy from The Fall...
Mark Smith,
He was in the foyer of the studio for some reason.
I used to love hanging around with Mark Smith.
Yeah, well, I never hung around with him, but I remember seeing him there. I can't remember the name of the studio. But anyway... Then I formed the first version of Frankie Goes to Hollywood with my mate Steve Lovell.
Yeah.
He was in also another group called Hamby and the Dance.
Right.
That signed to Virgin and had a studio called The Pink.
Right.
Which became quite a thing, The Pink, if you could get time in there. So I recorded loads of demos with Steve Lovell in The Pink. And went through various changes of name. But Frankie Goes to Hollywood was the one where a page from Guy Pillard's book, Rock Dreams, was stuck on the wall. And it was a picture of Frank Sinatra getting off a plane.
Yeah.
And the headline of it was Frankie Goes Hollywood. So that's where the name came from.
Were you a Frank Sinatra fan?
Not particularly. But Guy Pillard had also painted the cover of David Bowie's Diamond Dogs, which was one of my favourite albums.
I remember you recommending me that for a book that I was writing.
Okay.
Yeah, I asked you which record I had to go and get in a record shop, and you told me about Yeah.
Yeah, Diamond Dogs is great. Anyway, that book was a thing at the time.
Yeah.
But then I felt the music wasn't right in that version of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and I left.
Right.
But somehow it got included in to the Rock Family Trees Liverpool
in
edition.
The person who used to do them in the NME or the Melody Maker, or was it?
One of those.
Yeah.
It might have even been in Sounds.
In Sounds, right, okay. So it's like a history of Liverpool.
Yeah. So when I was in this other group with various members like Mark O'Toole and Peter Gill.
Yes.
When looking for a name, that was published that week, and we read this, that I'd been in this group called Frankie Goes to Hollywood that never did a gig.
Yeah.
And we took that name, basically, from a band I'd been in.
Yeah.
So there were two versions of Frankie, really.
Yeah, but the one that we all know and love,
the one
it came from all that. I mean, that's an incredible kind of like start to a band, isn't it?
It's a bit convoluted, I realise.
A supergroup that only became a supergroup after the event.
Yeah.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood that didn't exist to Frankie Goes to Hollywood that existed and went straight to number one all over the world. Well, let's kick off the listening party with the first couple of tracks from Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. This is The World Is My Oyster.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's listening party.
Shooting stars never stop, even when they reach the top. There goes a supernova, what a pushover.
Shooting stars never stop, even when they reach the top. There goes a supernova, what a pushover. There goes a supernova.
Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. Lovers roll.
Welcome to the Pleasure
That was the title track from Welcome to the Pleasure Dome by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And before that, the first song on the album, The World Is My Oyster. It's Tim Burgess here. It's a listening party. So we're going to listen to the whole album in its entirety.
Do we really have to?
We do.
Okay.
We do. It's important. It's important. And I think we've set the scene with the times as well.
Okay.
And, you know, it was controversial. The singles, I remember the first time I met you, I remembered queuing up at HMV in Manchester for Two Tribes.
Oh yes, I remember we spoke about that.
And I thought, to myself, I'm going to do this one day, and I managed to do it with the Charlatans, the only one I know. It's like
you did. You had.
I think there was one less. There was one less.
The best cheekbones in the business.
Oh well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's very kind. The World Is My Oyster, track one of Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. Can you tell me a little bit about that? It's only 1 minute, 57 seconds long, and it says here that it includes Well, Snatch of Fury.
Well, to be honest with you, those titles, I don't really see them as tracks or songs. I see it as an introduction, overture to the track, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
Yes.
So titles were put on them
For sequencing purposes, like, you know, to as links, really,
for
I suppose.
For whatever purpose, I don't know.
You don't know, yeah.
But they were nothing to do with me, the titles for those introductory parts of Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. So I just see it as a whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, a sort of 14-minute long opus of Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
Yeah. I mean, it is conceptual, I think, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. without a doubt. It has the war elements. It's like almost like, you know, the tribe element. You know, it has the kind of like, you know, your whole entity coming across. And you know, I gave it a spin this morning, very early, and hopefully sort of woke the neighbourhood up with it. And you know, it still kind of stands up, I think, as a, you know, as a piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, the track itself is really interesting. It's even got a prog moment in the middle with Steve Howe playing a guitar solo.
I mean, obviously that's the Trevor Horn connection. Steve Howe was in Yes at the time, I suppose, was he? Or about to join Yes.
Or at one point. I don't know.
But I mean, to have that, having come from punk and then, you know, leading the way, I think that's really fantastic.
Yeah, the thing I remember him most for was the Nepalese temple ball he brought with him. That was a feature of the session.
See, I like Yes now, but I grew up on punk, which is kind of weird, and I was not allowed to like it when I was a kid, although I did a little bit, but I really appreciate it now. Yeah. You know,
I like John Anderson when he collaborated with Vangelis, especially.
I love that.
I found Yes to be a bit of a hippie thing. Yeah. It was like Mods and Rockers, really. Hippies and punks were never the twain should meet, really. But, you know, it's all music.
It's all music in the end. But Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, you kind of like pretty much crammed it all in, right? The title track, and it was a single, and, you know,
it was eventually when they edited it down. I think that was a bit of a mistake. It should have been a 14-minute long single, really. It was silly to edit it down, in my view.
Because all the singles before it all had extended mixes, didn't they? You know, just brilliant.
That was all part of the promotion of the record. These amazing, especially Two Tribes, had amazing mixes. Yeah. One that Gary Moore played on, and then there was the really great New York mix of Relax. And the Sex mix that came out first and confused everyone because it didn't even include the song in it. And they got the revs per minute wrong, and people didn't know whether to play it on 33 or 45. It was...
Well, the whole thing with Relax is no one knew whether they should play it anyway, right? Including, who's the DJ who banned it?
Well, he didn't ban it. He refused to play it.
Okay.
During his program.
Right.
He was the Cliff Richard of DJs. I've described him as lots of things in the past. But really, he didn't have the power to ban the record. It came from much higher up. Once they'd seen the video for Relax that was directed by Bernard Rose and included a lot of alternate sexuality and drag queens and dubious practices, perhaps, I don't know. That was what really got it banned, in my view.
Right.
The video.
Well, let's hear that song we've been speaking about, a classic. This is Frankie Goes to Hollywood with Relax. That last track, of course, was Relax. And, you know, like, when it got banned, did you all collectively give each other a high five?
Well, no, the record company were thrilled. But I was a bit, oh, that means we don't get to perform it on Top of the Pops when we're number one. And, you know, it's our first single and it's really, really is number one. And so it was a double-edged sword, that, and it didn't get played on Radio 1, which at that time was the most important station that most people listened to. We did perform it on Top of the Pops when it was at number 34 or something like that in the charts.
Did they show that as a repeat or anything?
Oh,
or?
They're still showing it on Top of the Pops 2. you know, it gets shown a lot, that performance. And then after we'd had Two Tribes and The Power of Love go to number one, they unbanned it for Christmas Top of the Pops. The BBC.
That's an achievement.
Well, it was a year where Frankie dominated the consciousness of teenagers in the country. I mean, there was not, you know, denigrating Wham.
Right.
But, you know, or, you know, Duran Duran or any of those other groups that had loads of fans.
Yeah.
But we caused the most noise that year, I think.
Subversive.
Yeah, it was considered dangerous.
Yeah.
Lock up your daughters and your sons sort of vibe.
Would you like to tell me the story of you playing on the back of a trailer in was it New York or was it LA?
You mean a tank?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
On our way to Tower Records.
Yeah, and I knew I'd got the story a bit wrong, but you did tell me about it once.
It was L.A.
It was in L.A., on the way to Tower Records, down Sunset Boulevard in a tank.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they mistakenly gave me the loudspeaker walkie-talkie thing. And currently in the band at that time, there were lots of jokes about, have you got a tight box, which I kept repeating. I kept repeating over and over again for some reason. Yeah. And it's a bit, you know, silly. It's on YouTube somewhere.
I mean, driving down Sunset Boulevard in a tank could be considered silly, but it's amazing as well.
It was silly, but it was all to attract attention to the in-store signing thing. And we signed a lot of records.
Yeah.
We were acceptable in L.A., San Francisco,
New York. Yeah, that makes sense.
At that time.
Yeah.
It was all a bit dodgy in Cleveland, Dallas and...
That makes sense too.
Phoenix, Arizona, where we played...
It still would be, I think.
...much smaller theatres.
Moving on to track 4 on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, this is War. Mentioned a lot in this album.
War. The subjects of war.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously Two Tribes go to war. But then there's the Edwin Starr
cover version of Edwin Starr's War.
And I was wondering, you know, did you go through a Northern Soul kind of like phase?
I remember seeing Edwin Starr at Heaven.
Wow.
He did a PA there about the same time as Madonna.
Right.
And
was that like mid-80s then, or...?
No, it was very early 80s.
Early 80s, okay.
And I told someone at the record company that Edwin Starr was a great singer and far beyond the best club PA I'd ever seen.
Wow.
You know, eye-to-eye contact, war.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was just great, really professional. And so they said, to go with Two Tribes, why don't we do the Edwin Starr track War?
Right.
So it's has a theme, the 12-inch record.
Okay.
So we did a cover version of that at Ridge Farm.
Yeah, I've recorded there.
Yeah, in an afternoon, I think it was done. It had to be done quickly because we had a TV show to do that we did War and Lover's Got a Gun, which on the album is called Wish the Lads Were Here.
And so you're at Richard Farm, you did Wish the Lads Were Here and a cover version of War. And was that with Trevor Horn as well? Or, I mean, did you all just like... I mean, how many were there in the band?
And, five of us?
Yeah, five, and then Trevor and an engineer. And
those two tracks were mainly programmed by Andy Richards, the keyboard player who played on all that first album.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is a bit dodgy. It sounds a bit like ABC. And I got into trouble for saying that. I got shouted at.
Right, right. Well, we've had Martin on here.
I like Martin everything, yeah, and I've got nothing against ABC.
And he was working with Trevor Horn as well, wasn't he, at the time as
before
well?
Before us, yeah. But I didn't want to be in ABC.
No,
I wanted to be in Frankie Goes to Hollywood, thank you very much. So I wasn't keen on the way it was going stylistically, but...
It turned out pretty good, though.
Oh, yeah, it turned out great. Whoa, especially, I think...
Time for another song. Here's another classic, the UK number one. It's Two Flaps. Two Tribes. I mean, that was like your second number one. I think it's important that people know that.
It was very important to me that it was Two Tribes.
Yeah.
And not a dodgy version of Slave to the Rhythm that the producer was trying to get me to sing.
Right.
They presented...
Was that before Grace did it? Or...
Oh, way before.
Wow. I could see where it could maybe fit, but...
Well, you know, we had a number one, and the producer was getting a writing credit on Slave to the Rhythm.
Right.
And basically wanted us to record Slave to the Rhythm.
Got you.
Because
he
would have made even more
profit out of it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it just wasn't presented to me in a good shape.
That felt right to you.
It was like a stupid rock version of the song.
Okay, okay.
And it was terrible. It was just appalling. And I said, we've got Two Tribes. We don't need to do this. Yeah. Two Tribes is a much better song, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
And you've got me singing this really dodgy version of Slave to the Rhythm. It was great what Grace did.
Yeah.
They upped their game for it to be suited to her.
But it was post Frankie as well, so
they definitely
used your influence for that.
Yeah, they adapted the song for her voice specifically. But they weren't sure where to go on it when they gave it to me. So I was moaning about having to do it, and none of the other band members were interested in it either. So that demo is definitely not Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah.
But I just moaned and moaned until he decided to work on Two Tribes as a song.
Yeah. And
my belligerence prevailed.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It had to be that song. It couldn't have been anything else to follow up Relax.
Let's give the next couple of tracks a listen, starting with the unlisted track six, Tag.
Orgasm has become the most mystified state of feeling. No one can be quite sure if they have it or not. Is it just ejaculation or is it orgasm? Is it just involuntary pelvic contractions or is one having orgasm?
This is Tim's listening party on Absolute Radio.
With their own secret so ferry cross the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay.
Couple of tracks there, and then we get Born to Run. Bruce Springsteen, and we get Ferry Across the Mersey, which is kind of classic.
Yeah, that was the B-side of Relax.
Yeah, yeah.
On the 12-inch.
Yeah.
I wasn't keen to do that myself, but, you know, they came up with a beautiful version of it, a backing track, and I sang it quite well, considering I was so reluctant to sing it.
This is a good question, actually, about the T-shirts.
Okay, well, the Frankie Say Relax T-shirts were originally made by the record company.
Yeah.
To give away as promotional items to people in the record selling industry and...
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, as promo items.
The reps.
That's right, the reps. All of the... the sales team.
The sales team.
The strike force. all of those people. And no one wanted them. So they just... hung around in a cupboard in the offices in big plastic bags. And we were sent to America on a tour in November 1984 and we had no T-shirts or any merch whatsoever prepared. And so we bought those T-shirts and the right to reproduce them. Yeah. And sold them on tour, and that's how we earned money, because we didn't get any tour support, as far as I can remember, those Scroogey record company executives, and it exploded.
Yeah.
They were based on the Catherine Hamnett Choose Life T-shirts that Wham had already worn in a video.
Yeah.
The format of big black letters on a white T-shirt.
It works, though, doesn't it? I mean,
it works. It got the message across.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were easy to bootleg as well. So many of ours were sold, but so many bootlegs were sold that just said Relax, or Frankie Says Relax, or Who Gives an What Frankie Says, or, you know, all kinds of things. But it became a sort of an indicator of 1984, that T-shirt.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And a sort of an image of the 1980s.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Well, we briefly mentioned the Bruce Springsteen cover. Let's hear it. It's your version of Born to Run. Holly, earlier you told me about how the band started in Liverpool. Can you tell me some more about the Liverpool scene of the 1980s?
Well, it was a weird music scene in Liverpool. There was also another proto version called Dancing Girls that only ever appeared on television once.
Right.
With a terrible song called Shake Shake. And it's a bit embarrassing for me anyway.
It's a great title. So you got your name from Holly Woodlawn, from Andy Warhol.
Oh, the name Holly.
Yeah, the Holly. Yeah.
I was a big fan of Holly Woodlawn in the film Trash,
and big Warhol fan, I presume.
Yeah, with Joe D'Alessandro. And
how did you find out about Warhol then?
Was it... Well, I found out because in the 1960s, when I was a really little kid.
Yeah.
There was a documentary made by the famous photographer who Blow Up was based on.
David Bailey. Said it.
And it caused a great furore in the newspapers.
Oh, wow.
Specifically the Daily Mirror, which is what my parents had in the house.
Yeah.
And that tweaked my attention as a sort of 6 or 7 year old. And they kept saying it should be banned, this documentary. It shouldn't be on the television. And so when it did finally come on, I was there waiting for it and had special dispensation to stay up late.
Fantastic.
And it was a bizarre documentary, Andy Warhol being interviewed and getting someone else to answer the questions. Bridget Berlin flushing things down the toilet and taking photographs of it. And there were all these amazing trans people around. I think that's when I first heard of Hollywood Lawn and went to see the film Trash a few years later, when I was about 10 or 12, in a very seedy cinema that usually showed pornographic or blue movies, as they were called then. So seeing this Hollywood Lawn creation and Joe D'Alessandro naked created a lot of stirrings in my imagination. And I wanted to be Hollywood Lawn, living with a naked Joe D'Alessandro. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And who wouldn't want to be that?
I think that's amazing. I think, what an amazing upbringing.
It was in the air. It was the culture of the 1960s and 1970s. Everything was a bit out there. Then Mark Bolan arrived with glitter on his face and an acoustic guitar, which made me want to buy an acoustic guitar, which I somehow got that together. And David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, that was an Aladdin saying the first concert I ever went to at 13 at the Empire in Liverpool.
Amazing.
And then Roxy Music was the second concert I went to with my sister. The culture was quite different then, and that was all new, that sort of glam. Although it was, you know, they'd got it from Hollywood movies and things like that, the whole glamour thing. And Anthony Price, the fashion designer who designed the clothes for Roxy Music. Freddie Beretti, who designed the clothes for David Bowie and the Ziggy era.
Yeah.
They formed me, or, you know, my taste in music.
And I suppose, like, the actual fact that you played the bass for Big in Japan formed... But the bass lines are so incredible on the Frankie Goes Hollywood songs.
Oh, yes, because Mark O'Toole could really play the bass.
But you were obviously kind of like, you knew that I was having been a bass player.
I was aware of the importance of the bass guitar, and I was a fan of Mark O'Toole's bass playing. Asked him a couple of times to be in a band with me.
Yeah.
It happened in the end, but he was a bit reluctant at first.
Anyway, let's pick back up with the record. The next song on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome is San Jose.
Maybe truth will make you a star. Weeks turn into years, how quick they pass. And all the stars that never were are parking cars and pumping gas. You can really breathe in San Jose. They've got a lot of space. There'll be a place where I can stay. I was born and raised in San Jose. I'm going back to find some peace of mind in San Jose.
Track number 9 on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome was Do You Know the Way to San Jose? One of my favourite Dionne Warwick songs.
Absolutely. Or Burt Bacharach and Hal David songs.
Yeah, gorgeous.
You know, I love Dionne. We'd always done a version of it in rehearsals as a laugh, really.
Right.
And it was the song... I liked Walk On By as well.
One of my favourite moments of all time was presenting Dionne with an award.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, she's amazing, isn't she?
Yeah. So you were warming up and kind of like having a laugh with San Jose. You love Walk On By, you were saying.
Yeah, that was mentioned that we used to do, Do You Know the Way to San Jose in rehearsals.
Yeah.
So it was actually Ann Dudley
who
had orchestrated Two Tribes and The Power of Love.
Yeah. So
came up with the arrangement for Do You Know the Way to San Jose?
Yeah.
Which is quite different to Dion's version. And so it's a kind of sidebar on the album, like a segue into some other world.
Well, also a lead into Wish the Lads Were Here.
She's Lover's Got a Gun to Me and Always Will Be.
Right, okay. Yeah,
sorry, Lover's Got a Gun to Me. That's just the way it is.
We should retitle it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? That is a brilliant song. I love that.
It's great, isn't it? And a lot of people thought that was going to be our next single after Relax.
Right.
It was just not our next single.
It's a beautiful song.
Was it called the Oxford Roadshow?
I do remember it, yeah. I don't know what it was exactly.
We sang those two songs and it was a moment for us outside of Top of the Pops, but it was...
So this was like once the album had been released? Or before?
No, this was before, while we were recording it.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic.
It was the first song we ever wrote, me, Mark, and paired together in our very first rehearsal. It just came out within that song.
And what was the rehearsal space like?
It was a dump. it was a disused prison cell, now called the Bridewell Bar.
Right.
But then it was, I think it had Hessian on the walls or something, and each room was like a disused prison cell with a metal door with a hole in it so they could view the prisons.
Do you think it's important to have like rehearsal rooms like that in order for your sort of like dreams and sort of fantasies to become more concentrated?
No. I think rehearsal rooms for proto-creative types should be luxury facilities. I mean, how much do we make for the country, you know, in the music world? But we've all always been treated like, you know, low lives.
Right.
And always the last to get paid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people don't appreciate it enough what we do.
No. Agreed.
So they should be palaces that we get to rehearse in, to be honest.
Well, let's hear Wish the Lads Were Here on Absolute Radio. Ballad of 32. I've got written down here more war sounds, but more, this is more like bayonets and bugles and nukes.
The Ballad of 32, wasn't that sort of...
It's an instrumental.
Yeah, it's an acid trip, isn't it? It's a very stoned Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd-esque.
Yeah, yeah.
Concoction.
So, like, just say there's like an instrumental going on. Are you directing that, even though, you know, you're not actually...
I don't even think I was there. I can't remember.
Brilliant.
Nah, it just appeared out of nowhere.
So you won't be doing that live?
No, because there's no singing on it. What's the point?
I sometimes like doing...
I could use it as intro music, perhaps.
Yeah,
I don't know. But I'm not doing the whole album.
I know that.
I'm not doing every track.
You got plenty of other tracks to do.
Yeah.
But back to this. Crisco Kisses, love it.
Crisco Kisses, very sort of live type recording, as was Born to Run.
Yeah.
Crisco Kisses was a song that we wrote in the cells.
Yeah.
And I'd seen some weird cartoon. You know those very, very old cartoons where Mickey Mouse is in black and white? There's some odd character. And these characters were singing sort of bebop lyrics. And that's partly where the idea came from.
Right.
And I'd been going down to London, and these air stewards for British Airways, who I've met through a good friend, Jed Parker, talked about this strange practice of fist. Are you allowed to say that on the radio?
Of course you are.
And I just thought it was the most bizarre concept. I could not imagine that it was true, and it was just sort of some sort of urban legend. So I wrote a song about it, and it was about, you know, using someone as a glove puppet, basically. And that's the gist of that song. I will not perform that at the Albert Hall. Moving on.
Moving on swiftly. Let's hear the song we've just been talking about, Crisco Kisses. There's another one that I really, really loved when I was listening to it earlier, Black Knight, White Light.
A lot of people mention that song.
So now.
You know, I've never performed it live, bizarrely. We never did for some reason.
Maybe you can do it on your tour.
Perhaps. That's
you can just make a note, mental note.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
But a lot of people do say that, do they?
That is, for them, a great moment on the record.
It really is. And I wondered whether, because it's definitely like a different sound than, you know, Relax and Two Tribes. I suppose Power of Love is a different sound as well. But, I mean, this sounds different. And I wondered, you know, I didn't go through the who produced what or whatever, but did Trevor Horn work on that one as well? Or was that not?
Yeah, he was the producer of the record. But, you know, we already had the song prior to signing to ZTT, and it had the same bass line.
Yeah, I mean, the bass line again is
more
like,
or less. The bass was the most important instrument in Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and, you know, the four on the floor drum pattern. That was definitely what I envisaged Frankie to be, a sort of hybrid rock disco. Group. And it sort of straddled the sort of dance music that I was listening to in gay clubs like The Masquerade, Heaven, etc. And some sort of rock sensibility.
Were you living in London at that time, or just travelling to Heaven?
Not when I wrote Black Knight, White Light in the rehearsal rooms at the Bridewell in Liverpool.
Fantastic.
I was up and down. I was up and down and staying at the Columbia Hotel, which is where bands stayed at that time.
Yeah, I've stayed there.
Yeah, I'm sure, to do vocals and things.
Yeah.
But I was still signing on Social Security up until the point where we had to do Top of the Pops, and we said to the record company, If you want us to do that, we can't sign on anymore because everyone watches that program. So they had to put us on a wage of 40 quid a week.
Yeah, it's about average starters' wages.
I don't know. I think it was a bit below average, if you ask me.
Below average.
I knew, you know, factory workers on a lot more than that. Yeah.
Here's the 13th song from Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. Here's Black Knight, White Line.
Tell me we want to go. We are the leaders. Heavens above and hopes below. We are the leaders.
I do remember watching you on the tube.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I was devouring music myself, and it was quite a thing. You know, I think you managed to get the papers to be a little bit upset.
Yeah, we created a bit of a hoo-ha.
Yeah,
which was good.
It was
because I believed pop music needed a hoo-ha around it.
Because you think it had gone a bit flat from the Roxy times?
Well, it was all a bit David Cassidy,
right.
And for a while. And then David Bowie came along.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Hoo-ha is important.
Hoo-ha is important. Punk was hoo-ha.
Yeah, it was certainly was. And it was great that Frankie caused hoo-ha. We made our own video at the Hope and Anchor.
Yeah.
In North London.
Was this before Trevor Horn?
Oh, way before.
Yeah.
And they tried to shut us down.
Yeah.
Because they thought we were making a blue movie down there in our leather knickers and or the leather pets wore leather bikinis and the accoutrements of the fetish scene.
Yeah.
You can see that video in the Holly Johnson story at the Museum of Liverpool at the moment.
I'll be going to that.
Yeah. So that's on till next July and definitely worth going to see.
Yeah, I'll definitely go.
But more importantly, I'm on tour next year. I'm playing the Royal Albert Hall.
Nice.
I'm playing the M&S Bank Arena in Liverpool.
Yeah.
I'm playing Newcastle, Glasgow, Birmingham. And there may be more dates added, but you better be quick because they're selling out really fast. And that's, I can go now because that's the reason I'm here. But you've no doubt got other questions.
I
about
have.
Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
I do have more questions. Track 14, Only Star in Heaven.
Oh, yeah, I like that song.
Yeah.
I think Grace Jones liked it as well. A friend of mine went round to her flat and she was singing it and playing it quite loud.
Yeah. Have you ever met you and Judy?
No, I've been very close to her at the film premiere of Dune many years ago.
What, the original Dune?
The David Lynch Dune, which is the only one I've seen, to be honest.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the modern.
Are you a David Lynch fan?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, me too.
I saw Elvis Costello last week in the Olympia in Liverpool, and that was like being in a David Lynch movie.
Wow.
It was quite surreal.
Well, the production kind of...
production.
Yeah.
And he was great.
Yeah.
He's got a great voice.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's written some great songs as well. But I'm going a bit off-piste now.
No, I was going to say The Other Side of Summer is my favourite Elvis Costello track.
Oh.
And I do remember listening to Spike on cassette.
Okay, well, I love Shipbuilding.
Amazing song.
And his version of She, the Charles Aznavour
song
he performed in the film Notting Hill.
Yeah, I love Robert Wyatt's version of Shipbuilding.
Yeah, everyone says that.
Well,
Ibrahim
it kind of breaks me down a bit.
That as well. And it is great. And it's a bit off-putting because it's so great that no one else wants to cover it anymore.
right, yeah.
Because that version was so good.
Yeah, amazing. And so of the times as well, you know.
Yeah, it was actually co-written by Clive Langer from Deaf School.
Right,
guitarist.
Oh, wow. It all comes back to Liverpool.
It does.
Let's press play on The Only Star in Heaven. Yeah, yeah. That's The Only Star in Heaven by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which brings us to The Power of Love. Holly, you know, what else can be really said about it that's not already been said, but I'm sure, you know, you can add something.
Well, I'm very pleased that song exists.
Yeah.
You know, it's a song that I think will survive me and Frankie Goes to Hollywood in people's memories. Yeah. It's a song that will just be there forever, floating about in the ether. More so, even though Relax gets much more plays and Two Tribes gets many more radio plays, the power of love, I think, transcends all of that somehow.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to say about it, really.
Do you remember writing it? I mean, do you remember how you felt at the time? Do you remember where you were?
Yes, I do. I was living in Faulkner Street in Liverpool 8, and it's now called the Georgian Quarter, and it's quite posh. Yeah. But then it was sort of curb crawlers and street walkers, and I was in a Liverpool Housing Trust flat. And I laboured a bit over the lyrics, did lots and lots of different verses and somehow strung them all together.
Yeah.
And the first time it was recorded was for a John Peel session in late 83, I think November maybe.
Okay.
And it comes across as a big rock ballad in that. It's also got Andy Richards playing piano on it.
Okay.
But then it developed into this other thing where when Anne Dudley did the string arrangement and I went with her to CTS Studios that no longer exists in North London and watched her conduct the orchestra for The Power of Love and Two Tribes, which was amazing.
So she had what was the ZTT connection with Anne Dudley?
She was friends with Trevor, I think. And
was she in a band as well?
She was in The Art of Noise.
That was it, yeah.
And I think Moments in Love by The Art of Noise was a bit of an inspiration.
Got you.
For that song.
Interesting.
Also. You know, I had access to those songs even before they were released as singles.
Yeah.
There was cassettes knocking about and I'd play them at home. And so there's a lot that went into that song from, you know, being a choir boy in St. Mary's Wavertree when I was very young and having to go through the whole Sunday school thing. So it has got some religious references in it and other cliches about love.
Yeah.
And it was an ode to love rather than a love song to someone else. And I wrote it to manifest love into my life, really.
It's incredible.
Because everyone else had a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but I didn't because I was working really hard at Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't have time for anything else.
Yeah. That's an amazing.
So there you go. That's all I can think to say about The Power of Love.
And love came into your life, and
I always perform that, and it's always the last song.
Well, I've seen you do it, and
because you can't go anywhere after that song.
It's people wouldn't go home, would they?
Well, it's
they
a
wouldn't
sort
go
of
home.
Moment, you know.
Yeah.
They sing along to it, the audience, and it's all, I have to take my ears out to listen to them, and I'm looking forward to doing that at the Albert Hall.
I think, well, I'm looking forward to watching you do it.
I'm so in love with you, burns the soul. Make love your
so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's always great to see you.
Nice to see you. You're looking very well, actually.
You too. You and I've been seeing photographs on Instagram of you, and you're looking very dapper.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to drag my carcass around the country next June.
And that's all been to...
And sing for you all.
Well, I mean, I think it would be amazing. And I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Frankie C. Frankie C. Frankie C. Frankie C. No more.
That's Bang by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, concluding this listening party on Absolute Radio. Thank you to Holly Johnson for taking me to that classic album, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. As you know, every listening party, I like to recommend a few records that I've been listening to this past week. Let's have some KLF. We've mentioned Bill Drummond. I've been listening to that, of course I have. I listen to it all the time. It's What Time Is Love. Let's take a Julian Cope song, Me Singing, from the album Fried. T-Rex, brilliant band, Mark Bolan. Let's have Cosmic Dancer from Electric Warrior. So let's have Dead or Alive and Misty Circles. And while we're talking about recommendations, why don't you recommend this show to a friend? Tell them to replay any previous listening parties by just searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. They'll be able to catch up on every episode of the series. Texas, The Libertines, ABC, Travis, B-52s, Keen, and loads more from the past year. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. All songs written and composed by Peter Gill, Holly Johnson, Brian Nash and Mark O'Toole, except where noted. The album was released on ZTT in October 1984. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.